Welcome to History's Hotties, the podcast that discusses the sometimes forgotten but influential women in American history, and I am your host, Krista. So today we will wrap up our three-part series called To Marry an American President. But before we start, I have to say, if you hear any strange noises in the background, those are jet noises. Our family has moved again. I won't say to where, but I do hope you maybe get to hear a little bit of the awesome noise in the background, because it is, it's definitely, it adds ambiance rather than problems to the podcast, in my personal opinion. Our final woman who managed to capture the eye and the heart of a sitting American president was the most recent and the oldest of our three presidential brides. But first, as before, let's learn a little about our groom. Thomas Woodrow Wilson was born in 1856 in Staunton, Virginia, to Joseph and Jesse Wilson, and was brought up in a slave-owning family. After the war, the family moved to Columbia, South Carolina, where his father was a professor at the Columbia Theological Seminary, and then the family moved to Wilmington, North Carolina. Woodrow had a tough time learning as a boy, which some believe was caused by dyslexia, but which he blamed on the poor state of schools in the South. However, he overcame these challenges, graduating from Princeton University after a stint at Davidson, which, for those of you who aren't from the South, is a private university just a little north of Charlotte. He then went to 1 year of law school at UVA, but left because of poor health. A little over a year after that 1 year of law school, he went to Johns Hopkins University, where he finished his PhD with a thesis entitled Congressional Government, A Study in American Politics. While visiting a cousin, before this time at Johns Hopkins, he had met Ellen Axon, who later became his first wife. The two married in 1885 and had three daughters. Ellen died of Bright's disease on August 6, 1914, and while on her deathbed, she told her doctor to tell her husband she wanted him to marry again. This advice was definitely heeded, as Wilson was married to our history's hottie for today, Edith Bowling Galt, in December of 1915, which was just 16 months after Ellen died. So Edith Bowling was born on October 15, 1872, to William Holcomb Bowling and Sally White in Wytheville, Virginia. She was the seventh of 11 children. Edith has quite an impressive lineage from Thomas Jefferson, Martha Washington, Robert E. Lee, and even a first lady we have mentioned before recently, Letitia Tyler. However, Edith's most impressive ancestor is, in fact, Pocahontas. Edith, like her future husband, grew up in a family that identified with the fallen Confederacy. Her family could not pay the taxes on their land after the war, and this greatly affected her future life. While many of her siblings were enrolled in formal schools, she was not. Edith was her bedridden grandmother's companion, and while she was not in school, her paternal grandmother was very dedicated to her education. The impoverished family lived in very crowded dwellings to include both grandmothers, and Edith spent her days washing clothes and making sure her paralyzed grandmother, who had 26 pet canaries, by the way, did not get bed sores. However, at the same time, she was learning how to read, sew, crochet, knit, embroider, speak a mixture of French, English, and was also learning music. The family did hire a tutor for English literature, but until she went to Martha Washington College, where she studied all of the subjects normal for a well-bred young lady of the day, which would mean math, French, German, Latin, physics, government, geography, and by this time, typewriting was fairly common too. Until she left that school after two terms and later enrolled in Richmond Female Seminary, this tutor had been her only formal education. There are sources that say she only spent one term at Martha Washington College, but I was not able to confirm that information with multiple sources, so we'll go with the two-term theory. Apparently, the school had cold, crowded rooms, and the discipline was very strict, which would have been difficult to transition into after learning in a fairly unstructured environment. One of the most important things her grandmother Bowling instilled in her was a tendency toward efficient judgments and strong will, which would definitely serve her well later. Of course, President Wilson was not Edith's first husband, thus the Galt. Her sister had married into the Galt family and was living in D.C. While visiting her sister, Edith met Norman Galt, whose family apparently were owners of a jewelry store. The two courted for over 4 years and married in 1896. They had one son who died soon after birth, and the difficult delivery rendered Edith unable to have any more children. Norman died suddenly in 1908. So Edith is now a 36-year-old widow who took over her husband's jewelry store, and this is where we really see Grandmother Bowling's influence serve her well. She hired a manager to help run the store day to day, but always made sure the business was doing well. While she was able to do things like travel Europe, drive a nice car, and live generally as a very successful, relatively young widow, I can imagine she would have been strong and very independent, and with this sort of circumstance that she was now living in, very sought after in the D.C. area. Now, this is where the scandal begins. While there are sources that say Edith met the president in 1814, this does not mesh with the rest of our dates, so I am going to go with the more reasonable February to March time frame of 1815. My reason for using this date is only this. Edith met the president coming out of an elevator while in the White House in muddy riding boots. Edith was there to see the president's cousin, Helen Bones, who had taken over hostess duties in the White House after Ellen's death, which, of course, was in August of 1814. So the early 1814 date for the president and Edith's acquaintance doesn't really make sense since they were married just a few months after their first meeting. Edith was curious about the president and certainly shared a similar background, but there's no evidence to the rumors that surfaced after the two began a relationship. It was not long after meeting that Wilson and Galt began writing regularly and had a fairly short courtship. There are people who believe the courtship, and this is where the rumors came from, was too soon for Wilson and unseemly. The rumors were things like that the two had murdered the first lady, or had at the very least began having an affair when Ellen died, right when Ellen died. Wilson was facing re-election only 11 months after the two married, and his advisors were very concerned that his relationship would end any possibility of a successful campaign. After all, he had proposed to Edith only 3 months after meeting her. A rumor that surfaced that is far more likely to be true is that the president gave Edith an out during their engagement, telling her she could break off the relationship if she did not want to continue to face the public scrutiny. But like both Frances Folsom Cleveland and Julia Gardner Tyler before her, Edith decided to stand by her man. The common belief is that her reply was that she would not stand by him for duty, pity, or honor, but simply for love, which is certainly a very sweet answer. The wedding took place on December 18th, 1915, at her home in D.C., and the two were married by the president's pastor. They honeymooned on a trip to a hot springs in Virginia, and then to another resort in West Virginia. However, any scandal or rumor that was not enough to keep Wilson from being reelected. Edith herself was not outwardly political, but she was definitely very good at politics. The courtship letters between the two had entwined some political discussion amongst the professions of passionate love, and the two had been raised with similar backgrounds and beliefs, so that would not be surprising. After the wedding, Edith did not take on all the duties of the traditional first lady, which she really kind of left to a secretary. She began to work as more her husband's right hand. There was a world war going on, and he was certainly a very busy man. After Wilson attended the Paris Peace Conference, where he returned home for only a short time, he had returned home for only a short time before he had a stroke. There are some sources that say the cause of this was the stressful journey, and he had embarked on to convince the country that the League of Nations was a good move for the nation, and Edith had begged him before this journey not to go. Regardless of the cause, needless to say, his ability to run the country was diminished, and while Edith said at the time that she was only a conduit, she was definitely more than that. The U.S. never ratified the Treaty of Versailles, which is what Wilson's endgame really was, and it is believed that Edith had something to do with that. While her intention was to protect the president, not only because his health was frail, but because she did not want his cabinet to know the full extent of his illness. Unfortunately, her protection really turned into a source of contention that would haunt her for the rest of her life. The sentiment in the U.S. was very isolationist at the time, and Edith was either unable or unwilling to find a compromise between the president, who wanted this treaty ratified, and the League of Nations and the Senate, who the Senate was being completely intransigent about this. This was just one example of what Edith called her, quote, stewardship over the president. Papers had to be read to him, and Edith would decide which of those papers he would hear. Any decisions he made came back through her to the president's advisors and private secretary. She insisted she was not making the decisions. There are some differing opinions on whether or not she took on the power of the presidency, but it is known that not only did Edith have access to classified information, but she also knew some important wartime codes after the U.S. entered World War I. There is another story that goes along with the negotiations for the League of Nations as well. Apparently, a British ambassador had come over to help the president convince Congress to come to his side. But one of the ambassador's lower-level aides made a, quote, bawdy joke about her. I don't know what the joke is, and I really did try to find out. I wish I did know. I think it would probably amuse us very much. But Edith insisted the aide be fired or she would refuse his credentials. Refused the actual ambassador's credentials after this. The ambassador told her no. He basically told her to go jump in a lake, and so she sent him away. The thing that Wilson wanted to cement his legacy, this, you know, Treaty of Versailles, basically was gone. Regardless of whom wins the battle over Edith's real power aside, I think her, quote, influence on Wilson's legacy is difficult to deny after this particular story. So she's trying to protect his legacy, but yet she's kind of the person that came in between any kind of negotiations that the Senate and the League of Nations might have been able to have after his illness. So it really was a catch-22. Edith accompanied the president to Europe twice, with one of those being to visit troops during the war, and then again when the armistice was signed. This was significant because not only was this the first time a sitting First Lady traveled to Europe, but she attended gatherings with queens and other royalty, which put the First Lady kind of on equal footing with royal leaders of other countries. Now, I don't want to make it sound like all Edith did was sit there during meetings and pretend she wasn't being the bossiest wife ever, because she actually did other things. She volunteered at the Red Cross and observed rationing of meat and gasoline in the White House as well. She also let sheep graze on the lawn. Now, I have visited the White House, and the thought of sheep grazing on that lovely manicured lawn seems quite funny to me. But Edith's most amusing and somewhat scandalous platform was her campaign to reduce the incidence of venereal disease in battle-torn areas. I certainly have to applaud the willingness to be practical in her causes, because though Edith was being considered, like I said before, equal to the queens of the world based on her visits and who received her, I couldn't see Queen Elizabeth referring to sexually transmitted diseases to soldiers departing for war. During this time, Wilson himself loved watching newsreels made during his presidency. Of course, all the motion picture houses at the time would show a newsreel before a movie, and that is how many people saw their only images of what was actually happening to their fighting relatives and friends. And stories about the president during wartime would definitely be a common topic. So this arrangement, where Edith pretty much was the filter of what went to the president, and then what the president's words were back out to his advisors and his cabinet, pretty much stood until March of 1921, when the president left office. Wilson lived until 1924, while Edith cared for him in their home on South Street in D.C. After Wilson died, Edith did not ever remarry. She spent her time as the first head of the Women's National Democratic Club and then as the director of the Woodrow Wilson Foundation. Her legacy is a mixed one with historians. While some call her a devoted helpmate to an ailing president, others say she was power hungry and manipulative. However, the best quote I read was one that was certainly not meant to be flattering, but make some snarky references to the women's movement of the day, but also illustrates that women during this time could hold power even when the battle for equal rights for women was just beginning. It was from a Republican senator who said the First Lady was, quote, the presidentress who had fulfilled the dream of the suffragettes by changing her title from First Lady to Acting First Man, end quote. Clearly, that is not a comment the senator would have made publicly about a woman who had no ability to shape politics in any way. I would say that it does hint, at the very least, Wilson's contemporaries believed Edith held enough power that those who wanted to communicate with Wilson were resentful and willing to be rude when speaking about her. And though this would be small potatoes today, that comment would absolutely have been considered rude and polite company circa the early 1920s. So, clearly Edith had enough say-so on what was going on that some of the men around her were, you know, a touch resentful. She held the right to her husband's presidential papers, donating them to the Library of Congress when she was ready, and fiercely protected his legacy, as did our two other presidential brides. She wouldn't give access to any information on Wilson to any writers or filmmakers without keeping total control over the project, and her own memoirs have been challenged because of her claims about how she acted during Wilson's illness through the end of his pregnancy. Let's be honest, who other than me would have been shocked if she had just been an open book and given carte blanche to whomever wanted to interpret her beloved husband's legacy at will. If you have listened to any of my other podcasts, this is a common theme, especially for former first ladies, and I have to say, I appreciate the sentiment, whether it accompanies earlier misguided protection. What would we say about a first lady who just didn't care about her husband's legacy? I think the fact that the president picked a fiercely loyal wife says more about him than most of the facts I have presented about Edith. And now that I have digressed, I will get back to the end of Edith's life. Her only real post-First Lady politically motivated appearance, before she supported John F. Kennedy in the 1960 presidential election, was to appear with FDR when he declared war in 1941 to draw a link between that day and the April 1917 declaration of war. So she had gone basically for 40 years until John F. Kennedy came along, where she just, you know, if she made a public appearances, they were only, you know, for appearance. They were not politically motivated except for that declaration of war, which I would say was, you know, a pretty important thing for her to do. Another interesting fact is that while we may have heard there is some camaraderie between former first ladies, that is evidently very true in this case. Edith remained close with Grace Coolidge, Eleanor Roosevelt, and Mamie Eisenhower. Apparently they were very good friends. When Edith died at the age of 89 of congestive heart failure, she was buried at the Washington National Cathedral. She left her home to the National Trust for Historic Preservation, which again is fairly common if there are no heirs for property for, former first ladies. So this wraps up our three-part series on the ladies that stole the heart of a sitting American president. I hope you feel like you've learned a little, because I certainly have. I think we've come up with some common themes. And apparently if a president wants to have a really, really fiercely loyal first lady, sometimes finding her when he's already president can be just the ticket. I have been given a couple of suggestions for future episodes, so thank you, Jenna. I'm definitely beginning some research. So if you have any questions or comments, please email me at historieshotties@yahoo.com. That's historieshotties@yahoo.com. Leave out the apostrophe, or visit our Facebook page. There are actually two Facebook pages by the same name, so just look for our yellow Histories Hotties logo. So until next time.